Hello and welcome. I am with Graham Ashworth, Managing Director International of Archive 360. Welcome, Graham. Thanks for joining us here today.
Welcome.
How are you?
Very good. Yeah, we've had a good show.
Been, good.
Very engaging.
Yeah,
you've been... Lots of people interested in what we do and come to see us after the presentation we gave yesterday, so it's been very good, very positive.
Yes, definitely. And when I've seen your stand has been really busy every time I've walked past and when I've been speaking with you, so it's really nice to see that level of engagement with your stand. So let's just get right into it. If we can discuss a little bit about what has brought you to this position as a Managing Director International of Archive 360. What's been your journey to this point so far for me?
Yeah, so I've been in the technology space for quite a few years.
Mm.
And I'd say probably for the last 15 years or so, I've been very focused on archiving as a concept and worked for various different vendors in different roles, predominantly sales.
Yeah.
And you know, that journey has gone from archiving email to try to make Microsoft Exchange a little bit smaller, more cost effective to run. Still need to retain the records, but they don't need to live in a primary application forever. And then the use cases have increased to things like application decommissioning.
Right.
So use case here is around M&A activity, for instance. Suddenly you've got two of every application. You don't need two.
Okay.
Or perhaps it's something that people address as part of their modernization to new applications. So I've seen a lot of changes. But my role is really from sales through to senior management. I work with a number of vendors that have been predominantly in the US and they're trying to get a foothold in the UK or in wider international. I've helped those organizations get a foothold here and to build the team, build some talent around me. So that's what I've been doing the last 15, 20 years or so.
Lovely. And does that include public sector organisations who are international, or are we talking mainly private sector in that work?
A bit of both. I don't think any more than about 20% of our customers are in one particular sector.
Okay.
We work very closely with financial services because they're very heavily regulated, so they need to treat their data in a specific way. But you also find that construction companies need to keep their data for many years. They build bridges and they may need to keep the design for that bridge for the life of that bridge. That might be 100 years.
Mm.
And public sector is one of those areas where they are essentially funded by the taxpayers. So they need to treat their data, their systems in a way that they're providing a good return on investment. So generally they're eager to understand how they can save costs, how they can reduce risks.
Mm.
So I've found the public sector very engaging.
Yep.
We do, as we're a technology vendor, we do rely on partners that have existing relationships with public sector customers.
Yeah.
So we don't tend to work directly with public sector. We work with our trusted partners, like through technology that we've presented with today.
Of course.
They're on the right catalogues. They understand the public sector really well.
Mm.
And that helps us really get a foothold into public sector. So it's been fun. We've seen lots of interest from public sector. So I think we'll be doing more in this space. I hope so.
Perfect. Yeah. And likewise. So, Graham, let's jump into how data is being used then, I guess, in terms of archiving. So for many, including myself, archiving can be thought about as sort of like storing stuff for later. How do you challenge that perception?
Yes, people think of a library and
yep.
You know, the less active books, the less well-read, they go in some dusty corner. It does evoke those kind of thoughts and principles about it. But archiving has a few different concepts to it. And it's actually changing all the time with the advent of AI. So some organizations look at archiving because they're heavily regulated and they need to have an immutable copy of a communication, for instance. So it can't be changed, can't be altered. You've got to get to the who said what and when. So it has to be legally defensible. So that's a good reason to archive.
Yep.
To make sure that you're meeting particular standards of record keeping. But we're also seeing archiving used as a way to discriminate between active data and inactive data. So do you want your inactive data to be on the most highly expensive, most performant storage? No, you don't. What you want to do, if you need to retain that data and can't dispose of that data.
So is that sometimes described as having data cold rather than having data hot? And if so, what are the ways that organizations can move that data from a cold to then use it for day-to-day operations and decision-making? Is that easy to do, or it can be quite difficult once something's archived?
Yes, so those are terms that are kind of widely used by the likes of the Amazons and the Microsofts of this world.
Right.
The less active data is, the colder and colder the storage it can get, so it's more cost effective.
Mm.
The challenge then is if actually that data is required, it suddenly becomes active, perhaps as part of a search or an e-discovery or subject access request, then it needs to be moved to warmer storage, and there's always a price then for egress between the different layers.
Yeah.
So it is a method of continuing to reduce the cost of storing data.
Mm.
The challenge is, if you need it, then it becomes a little bit more expensive. So there's always a trade-off, and we try to provide some intelligence to our customers about what can be archived, what is inactive, and they can build a case for moving it to somewhere cheaper and cheaper.
Yeah. So some of your customers and clients that you work with now, whether that be in the public sector or elsewhere, have you got any examples that you can share where they've used some of their archive data to uncover, whether it's a new opportunity or to improve citizen experience in some sense, or to improve a process that's like nothing to do with compliance?
Yeah, well, interesting times. So quite often clients will archive data and they'll never touch it. Sometimes they think they'll never touch it. But they have an e-discovery event, regulatory inquiry, an internal investigation, something like that, and then suddenly they actually need the data. So you never know. But the interesting thing now with AI and machine learning is that your aged data, your inactive data, can actually be really valuable, because there's lots of it. It's great for training your analytics tools and your AI engines, because it could look back at that corpus of data and learn an awful lot about trends, interactions with your clients or your consumers, etc. So it's actually really good, it's really valuable suddenly to gain insight into your data. So it's great training material for sort of the machine learning engines. And one of the good things with archiving is that you have an immutable copy of the data. So it's something that hasn't changed. You can rely on it. It's accurate. And you can put a lot of good entitlement around the data as well. So if you have PII in your data, you can mask that data.
What's PII? Sorry,
so that's publicly identifiable, identifiable information.
Great, yep, cool.
Yes, so it could be a credit card number. It could be a national insurance number.
Yep.
Not something you want to put into absolutely. So if you mask that, it's one of the things we do at an archive layer, then you've got some defensibility, you've got some modicum of security.
I understand. Right, okay. And that comes on to some of the advantages of a modern archiving platform like Archive 360. So what are some of the fundamental differences between a legacy archiving platform and something that's modern, cloud-native, like Archive 360?
So a lot of legacy archiving platforms are on-premise, and there is a move to the cloud.
Yep.
Quite often, they're very proprietary to that a source of data, so they archive the data from that application, and that's all they do.
Mm.
So you end up with silos.
Yeah, and they won't speak to other silos, and it's
100%. So if you want to search against that data, you might have to go to six different archives.
Yeah.
The beauty of a modern system that can take anything as really unstructured as an email to anything really structured as SAP data in an ERP system. And everything in between is that you're collapsing all of those silos, and you can have one search rather than six searches to separate silos and archives.
Yeah, and that's a particular point of concern for government in general, is to break down those silos, particularly within central government. So to really, really share solutions, and that's part of what we try and do at DigiGov, is bring everyone together to sort of find out the common challenges and then try and pinpoint a solution that one government department may have found, and then other government departments can sort of benefit from that, really. So there is a question that I'd like to bring up around security and then control of data, and then I guess the element of training an AI system on that data. You mentioned briefly about the public identifiable information.
It's not easy to say.
No, it's not. I'm glad we both slipped.
Let's just say it's PII.
Yeah, PII. I know you touched on that briefly, but also if you were to train an AI system, a large language model, on some of this archived data, would you then have to also train it on like a large corpus of information? So as a sort of better understanding and a better worldview. Otherwise, surely it'd just be hallucinating based off the sort of small sample training data that it's been fed on.
Yeah, they're very data hungry. So the more data,
the better.
The better, as long as it's defensible. Again, if you're masking PII,
yeah,
that's a good thing. You don't want that kind of 100%. So one of the things that you know we do with archiving is actually look at the provenance of the data. Make sure you have one copy. You might have 20 copies of an email, but you want the one copy that has been held immutably, so you can trust that copy.
Right.
So having trusted data to train your AI models, if someone comes and says, well, where did you get this data from? How were you able to make your decisions against this data? Then you have to defend that. And
yep.
You have to
100%.
Be very clear that that data is trusted data. The AI engines are very, very data hungry, and lots of organizations that think, well, how do we feed enough information for it to gain some insight? So breaking down those silos so you have that data available. Again, trusted data is really important on that journey. You really need the foundations in place before you can get value and insight into that data. You touched on security.
Yes.
So actually, one of the drivers for our prospects is that they often have data that they need to retain that could be sensitive in obsolete systems. So they're keeping the systems even though they're obsolete because the data... They
sensitive.
Need to retain the data. Well, quite often those systems are not hardened in the same way from a security standpoint like the modern production systems are.
So are you telling me they could be hacked?
We have quite a few instances where clients have come to us and said, we have been hacked. Some of our customer data has made its way out of our organization and we've been fined. So we need to improve our security posture. And they know it's these obsolete legacy systems that are risks. So what we can do is we can help liberate the data out of these obsolete systems and put them in a modern architecture that is hardened in the way that you would you'd want to harden. We can encrypt the data, etc. So up to clients, very stringent security standards, so they have peace of mind.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's super important. Could you, I'm just going to ask you on the spot here, but could you walk us through a specific use case where you've worked with a customer that's been able to use AI and with their archived data, and what kind of discoveries have they been able to get?
Yes, okay. Well, actually, there's an interesting one around cost optimization. So we're AI agnostic. So we have built AI into our application to make it run better, be more intuitive to use.
Yep.
But we're not going to compete with the Microsofts,
the
Googles, Snowflake are demonstrating here. That's their bag. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. That's their focus. So we say to clients, so we'll provide the foundation layer, access to the data ultimately. But you choose whatever you want to choose.
Mm.
You've made your own investments. Do you know what? They can change tomorrow. We don't care. It's being open and extensible, and you choose your ecosystem, and we will make that data.
And they'll
available.
Sit on top of the Archive 360 platform.
They will, yes. Yeah. So we'll often these technologies can reach in to our archive and analyze the data there.
Yep.
We have tight integration with Copilot Studio to do that.
Great.
But often they'll want the metadata. Mm. You know, we keep the artifact, but they'll want the metadata associated with it to train their engine. So they're sending much more data. Much less data into those AI engines. They can be quite costly. There's an awful lot of compute behind these AI models, a lot of energy needed. And the challenge is sometimes that organizations put all of the data into these engines, and then they've got to work out whether actually the insights are valuable enough against the spend. So what we've been able to do is say, look, let's be proportionate about this. We'll store the data very cost effectively on these archive layers. And then you choose what data you need at one point.
Right.
So you can be really quite proportionate to reduce the cost down. In terms of the AI use cases, I mean, they're too vast to consider.
Yeah.
And people are still you're thinking about, you know, what insight they can get out of AI. What's it going to do for their business?
Yeah, definitely. And so if I was to put you in the shoes of someone within the public sector who's potentially new to this, where should they start? What is a first step in sort of preparing some of their archive data to be used with AI? Is it a matter of sort of cleaning it up, tagging it correctly, storing it, or is it more about the platform itself?
You know, we provide a foundational layer for AI. The first thing I would get those organizations to think about is what data from what applications, and think about, you know, the security, think about the entitlement. Should that data end up in those AI models? You've got to build those pipelines. You've got to build the foundation. You've got to build the governance and control and security around that. So there's a lot of upfront thinking about the appropriateness of the data into those AI models. So that's the first thing I would think about.
So the planning and preparation is paramount.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And that's where we can help.
Perfect. Okay, so before we finish, I'd like to ask you, so outside of the world of archiving and data, if I could cast your mind to more about the show in general and DigiGov, is there anything outside of your main remit that has sort of inspired you that you can probably take away, and when you get back to the office, whether it be tomorrow or next week, is really going to put some coals in the fire, as it were?
Yeah, so the great thing about these events is so many people working from home and hiding behind your Teams calls,
yep.
And it can be challenging to build relationships and talk more informally and try to understand a little bit more about the business needs and the individuals and what they want to try and get out of the project as well. So it's good to meet in person. I think it's a totally different interaction than just via email. So I'm a great believer in people being face-to-face with other people and you know, learning an awful lot.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of interest in our stand, which has been great, but we've talked to people about what they've got out of the show and which other vendors they like. So we find an awful lot about the marketplace, and we also find out an awful lot about what's happening generally in public sector. So we spoke to a very large central government department yesterday, and they said, oh, we are really trying to drive more engagement with SMEs, small, medium enterprises.
Great.
That was really interesting to learn.
Refreshing to hear.
Yes. Well, we work with partners that are very niche, but they're quite small organizations, very specialist in what they do. So that was good to hear. Mm. Actually, they were looking to really encourage those small, unique enterprises that are all about driving value. So sometimes you hear an awful lot of really good stuff that you can utilize and understand.
Definitely.
That's not actually completely related to the topic of what we do.
Yeah.
So it's great to hear about those trends.
Lovely. And thank you, Graham. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today. And thank you also for speaking yesterday in one of our theatres. So it's great to have you. Should we? Would you like to finish with some final thoughts?
Look, it's a great event. I really enjoyed it. I think you're doing it again next year, so we're looking forward to it. We'd love to have another speaking slot about another topic, perhaps. So.
Well, we'd love to have you back, Graham. The dates for DigiGov 2026 are the 23rd and 24th of September in the XL London. So, Graham, we look forward to having you there, and we look forward to having you there as well, listening along. So, thank you.
Lovely.
Thank you, Graham, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you.